Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Freedom's Last Gasp by M. A. Rothman. Narrated by Tim Campbell. Freedom is never more than one generation away from extinction. We didn't pass it on to our children in the bloodstream. The only way they can inherit the freedom we have known is if we fight for it, protect it, defend it, and then hand it to them with the well-fought lessons of how they in their lifetime must do the same. And if you and I don't do this, then you and I may well spend our sunset years telling our children and our children's children what it was once like when men were free. Ronald Reagan. Chapter 1.
Ave Maria, gratia plena, Dominus tecum, benedicta tu in mulieribus, et benedictus fructus ventris tui, Jesus.
The Pope's recitation of the Angelus prayer was transmitted from Earth, across millions of miles of space, received by the mining colony, and echoed throughout the Chrysalis Mental Health Hospital. Terry Chapper paused in the hallway and bowed his head. Ranger, his German shepherd, mimicked his reverential motion while remaining alert. Terry, too, kept his senses razor sharp. Seeing as he was currently covering a shift for one of the hospital security officers, he had to, especially here in the Green Ward. This was the section of the hospital reserved for patients who were prone to violence, sealed off from the outside world by a minimum of 3 sets of biometric locks. As the prayer came to an end, a middle-aged nurse hurried toward him.
Terry, we've got a situation with Calloway. He looks like he's about to—
I got him, Terry said, giving her a reassuring pat on her shoulder. He fast-walked to the east wing and found Josh Calloway in the hall. The former soldier was almost 300 pounds of muscle, with a face that looked like it had been etched from stone. He was dressed like every other patient here, blue scrubs, footy socks, and a medical tag on his wrist, but he looked perfectly healthy. Looks were deceiving. Calloway was walking along slowly, brushing his right shoulder along the wall and making hand signals that to most people would have meant nothing, but to Terry meant everything.
Hey, Josh, buddy, are you with me?
Calloway didn't respond. Ranger growled at Terry's side and Terry snapped his fingers. Sit. The dog obeyed, his ears lying flat, and huffed with frustration. Calloway's gesticulations grew more animated. The soldier was in another place, another time. Suddenly he bellowed,
Carbon Outlaw 5-4, Hawkeye 13, 3-4.
With the most authoritative voice he could muster, Terry replied,
Roger 13, just got a call from 3 that LZ X-ray is clear.
Calloway's eyes widened and he stared into space, seeing something that wasn't there.
Negative, Carbon Outlaw. I've spotted Charlie on the cliff rise of Chupong Massive. They're setting up an ambush. I'm 4 clicks east-southeast and have visual. LZ X-ray is not clear. Repeat, LZ X-ray is not clear.
Terry had studied Calloway's background. The soldier had never been off colony, so whatever scene was playing through his mind was born of delusion.
Copy that, 13, he said, arranging with DASC to scramble fighters for LZ X-ray.
One of Terry's backups came around the corner down the hall, a stun wand at the ready, but Terry waved the backup away.
Arranging for dust-off at LZ Victor, he continued. Medics are on the scene, you copy?
The tension in the huge soldier's face eased. Terry approached cautiously.
Sergeant Calloway, stand down. We're holding the position.
The patient pulled in a deep breath and let it out slowly. Tears rolled down his cheeks and he blinked, his gaze returning to the present.
I'm sorry, Terry.
He wiped his eyes with the heels of his hands.
I lost time again.
Terry swallowed hard and patted him on the arm.
It's good, Josh. No harm done. Come on, let's go get you refreshed on your meds.
The sedative will keep him under for at least a handful of hours, said a blue-smocked nurse as she scribbled something on the holographic image of a tablet computer. I'm impressed that you managed to penetrate his delusion. We usually have to stun him when he gets that way.
They stood at the entrance to Josh Calloway's room. Even in his sleep, the twitching of the man's fingers was a telltale sign of the traumatic brain injury that hadn't yet healed. Terry felt a connection to the damaged soldier and his struggles.
Is he getting any better? Terry asked. What's his prognosis?
The nurse made the tablet disappear with a swipe of her hand, then motioned for Terry to follow her to the nurse's station. Well, considering the whack he took in that accident practically caved in the side of his head, he's doing fantastic. The nanites are doing their job. I figure in another month he'll be back to normal, though he probably won't remember a lot of what happened. That's the stuff that we usually can't get back, the most recent memories. As head of security for the mining colony, Terry knew what had happened to Calloway, and it certainly wasn't an accident. The UN had sent over another spy, who had somehow gotten past most of the security checks. But he hadn't gotten past Calloway. The spy ended up ambushing him with a blow that would probably have killed a smaller man. Terry vowed to never let another of those UN scumbags get past their perimeter. He just wished he knew what the hell they were looking for. Hey, Terry. It was Candace, one of the nurses, waving at him from the break room. Up for a soda? He walked in and joined her. Hey, Candace. She looked past him to Ranger, who had stopped just outside the doorway, an untrusting look on his furry face.
Hey, pup, she said. It's okay. I think I can find you a treat if you like.
Ranger wagged his tail, turned around, and walked backwards into the room.
What in the world?
Terry chuckled. When I first got him, he was a bit of a mess. The vet said he'd been found in one of the deeper mines, his nose broken because he'd run into a glass door. I don't even want to say how many credits it cost to patch him up, but it was worth it. But as a result, he's not very trusting of doorways.
Oh, you poor thing. I'm sorry the glass door gave you an ouchie.
Candace knelt down and gave Ranger a dog biscuit. He ate it out of her hand, his tail a blur. Terry patted Ranger as he licked up the crumbs that had fallen to the floor. Then he grabbed the dog's face, gave him a kiss on the top of his snout, and said, "Damaged goods or not, I wouldn't have you any other way." Priya lay in bed, listening through earbuds to the recording of the last lecture she'd given, her alarm clock beeping all the while.
Okay, folks. For those of you who weren't awake last week, I'll remind you that we covered the Seebeck effect and how it enables the conversion of temperature differences into voltage via thermocouples. As you know, we have decaying elements like strontium-90 within these thermoelectric generator packs that power most of the handheld gadgets we own nowadays. By necessity, these long-lasting power packs contain strong beta particle emitters that need to be shielded, and the sheer act of stopping the beta particles produces Bremsstrahlung, a more penetrating type of radiation which needs to be dealt with as well. Today we'll cover how we calculate the thickness of the shielding needed and the different options we have.
Every time she heard a recording of herself, she was surprised by how noticeable her British accent was. It bothered her, but not so much that she cared to do anything about it. She was far more peeved by the professor who told her she came off a bit snarky when lecturing. If that was true, she needed to deal with it. Long term, it was probably a waste of time, but she needed to play the game if she was going to get her PhD. Her bedroom door opened, and Aunt Jen turned the light on.
It's almost 7. You'll be late for school.
Priya had lived with her aunt since she was 17, just after her parents' untimely death, 7 years ago. Aunt Jen had no kids, had never wanted kids, but she'd volunteered to look after Priya, and for that Priya was grateful.
I'm ready,
she groaned. She flipped off the covers, revealing that she was already fully dressed. Aunt Jen looked over her spectacles and sniffed disapprovingly.
Don't forget you agreed to walk over to the tube station with Mrs. Pete's little urchin. It's her first day at school, and I'm sure she's waiting impatiently at her apartment. I'll be out in a second.
Aunt Jen retreated, leaving behind a hint of rose perfume that made Priya a bit nauseated. She slapped the button on the top of her alarm clock, glanced at the mirror hanging above her dresser, and grimaced. Her thick mop of dark hair fell over her shoulders. It would need a good 10 minutes of brushing if she was going to get all of those tangles out. 10 minutes she didn't have. She settled for roughly raking her fingers through her unruly hair, then she grabbed her bag and headed out. It was a beautiful morning in South Florida. A breeze carried the scent of freshly cut grass and even a hint of the ocean, though the shore was a good 10 miles away.
Priya!
She turned to find Anna Pete hurrying over to her. Anna was an adorable 5-year-old with pigtails, a freshly pressed school uniform, and a backpack almost as big as she was. The girl smiled.
I was worried you forgot we are going together today. No chance, Jellybean.
The two walked hand in hand from their apartment complex toward the tube station.
Are you excited about your first day at school?
Anna looked up at Priya with big blue eyes.
I'm okay,
she said with a tremor in her voice. Priya gave the little girl's hand a squeeze.
You've taken this kind of trip plenty of times. How about this? Let's test how much you know. If you're really ready for school, you should be able to pass this quiz. Want to try? Okay, I'll try.
The girl brightened a bit.
Where are we, and where are we going?
Anna pointed at the tube station sign.
That's easy. We're in Coral Springs, Florida, and I have to go to Mrs. Robinson's class at the David Holmes Space and Science Primary School at Cape Canaveral.
Priya frowned.
You're right. That was too easy. I have to think of a harder question.
Anna grinned. They walked up the stairs to the tube station, passing a matronly woman carrying an armful of groceries, and as they reached the top, a hologram of a smiling recruiter wearing a lab coat with a government logo blinked into existence just ahead of them. Welcome, neighbor. It's people like me who keep the tubes running efficiently and safely. Type *92-8374 on your SMS device to learn more about joining the team.
Okay, let's see how you do with this question, Priya said. How far away is our destination? Still easy. Cape Canaveral is 300 kilometers away. That's 185 miles.
They'd arrived at the arrivals and departures platform, and Anna stepped up to a control panel. It lowered by about a foot so it was easy for her to reach, and she pressed her hand on the touchscreen. The display automatically switched to her custom settings, and a woman's voice spoke with a British accent.
Good morning, Anna. I'm Lexi, your tube assistant. You have authorization for 4 different destinations on your account. Where would you like to go?
Anna turned to Priya and pointed at the screen.
See? It lists a distance to Cape Canaveral, right there. It also says it'll take about 15 minutes, so...
Her face scrunched up as she concentrated.
Our top speed should be right around 1,400 miles per hour, and we won't have any more than about a 0.3G acceleration.
Priya smiled at her precocious neighbor.
That's amazing. Who taught you how to calculate acceleration like that? Duh, it's not that hard. It's just delta V over delta T and then convert the value to Gs.
Anna tilted her head and frowned.
You taught me that, ages ago.
She turned back to the control panel.
Lexi, I need to go to school. Priya's coming with me. 2 passengers for the David Holmes Education Campus at Cape Canaveral. Please confirm.
Confirmed, Anna said with an exaggerated nod. The sound of rushing air grew louder behind the metal doors to the tube.
Establishing vacuum. Queuing request for transportation link between Coral Springs, North Junction, and the main terminal at the DHEC Cape Canaveral.
Priya put her hand on Anna's shoulder.
See? You're an expert at this stuff. Yeah, I guess. But it's still nice not going by myself. Link complete. The car is arriving in 3, 2, 1.
With a loud hiss, the doors slid open, revealing an empty capsule with 2 well-padded armchairs inside.
The car is now ready for boarding.
They entered the capsule. As soon as they were both seated, the doors closed and Priya felt the air pressure change.
We are about to depart.
The automatic safety harnesses built into their chairs activated, wrapping a gauze-like mesh around their legs and chests. Priya knew the harnesses provided only an illusion of safety. The truth was, at speeds exceeding Mach 2, if they ran into any kind of trouble, no harness could keep them alive. There wouldn't be enough of them left to scrape into a jelly jar. That was how Priya's parents had died. Without a whisper of noise, they departed the Coral Springs station, their capsule slowly increasing speed. Their seats automatically swiveled in the direction they were accelerating, and in less than a minute, they began slowing.
Passengers, we are arriving at the main Fort Lauderdale switching terminal. Please remain seated. Your car will automatically be routed to the proper queue for high-speed transport.
A hologram of a safety technician appeared in the car.
Welcome, neighbor. You're about to embark on a transport that will see you traveling across our great state at a velocity well in excess of the speed of sound. Some passengers may have moments of discomfort upon seeing the land streaking by at these rates, so be aware that all our cars are equipped with dimming portals if needed. And if for any reason you feel that you must interrupt this travel, please take note of the red emergency button on each chair. Hold it down for 3 seconds to request an emergency reroute. Are there any questions?
No, Anna said.
The hologram shifted his gaze to Priya, and she smiled and shook her head.
Okay, then. Relax, and you'll be on your way in 45 seconds. Thanks for listening patiently, and enjoy your trip.
Priya looked out the window at all the other tubes converging on the switching station. Off in the distance, some workers in vacuum suits were using a plasma cutter to service a tube car that had been lifted onto a service gurney. Then their capsule started forward once more, gliding smoothly along a magnetic rail before switching onto a new cue.
"Do you know why it's always quiet inside the tube?" Priya asked Anna.
Anna shook her head.
"I'm not sure. Sounds can't travel through a vacuum." "We're in a vacuum? I didn't know that." "Of course. These cars can only achieve such high velocities when they're in a frictionless environment."
Anna's eyes widened with understanding.
"That makes sense. No air, so no wind slows us down. And we're on a mag rail, so we don't touch anything the entire time."
"That's right.
And do you know why sound doesn't travel in a vacuum?" "Is it because..."
The little girl pursed her lips, focused for a few seconds, and then shrugged.
"I don't know." "Because sound is actually a mechanical wave, and waves spread by vibrating particles in the air, but..." "And a vacuum doesn't have air,"
Anna announced triumphantly, as if making a new discovery.
"Exactly right." "Attention, your car is next in line for departure. We are departing the Fort Lauderdale switching terminal in 3, 2, 1.
Priya was pushed back against her seat as the capsule accelerated. A screen at the front of the capsule showed their speed, and in just over a minute they'd broken 400 miles per hour. As Anna looked out the window, Priya settled in for the short trip, thinking about the cryptic email she'd gotten last night and wondering what it meant. The sender was a Colonel Jenkins from a part of the military she'd never even heard of. He asked to meet her in the hallway just outside her relativistic quantum field theory class when it was over. How did he know what classes she was taking? At first she was kind of intrigued, but now that she'd had time to think about it, the email sort of weirded her out. Who was this guy? And more importantly, what did he want with her? Sitting in a booth at Mama Tina's Diner, a hole-in-the-wall restaurant located just on the edge of campus, Priya's stomach growled as she scrolled through the menu choices. She settled on a dish her mother used to make.
"Priya!"
She hit submit on her order and looked up as Karen Tian, one of her physics classmates, came over from a nearby table, bringing her plate of food with her. She set herself up across from Priya.
"Hey, Karen," Priya said. "I thought you only came to this place during late-night cram sessions when all of the junk food machines go offline."
Karen shook her head, sawed at whatever gravy-covered thing she'd ordered, and popped a bite into her mouth.
"Nah, this stuff is also good for hangovers. And let me tell you, don't ever let anyone try to convince you that plum wine can't get you drunk."
"Order ready," announced the artificial voice of the electronic waiter. A slot opened in the device and a plate of steaming spinach dotted with cubes of cheese rolled out. Holding her hair out of the way, Priya leaned down and took a deep sniff of the ginger, garam masala, and garlic.
"What's that?" Karen asked. "Palak paneer. It's a traditional Indian dish. Basically a spinach puree with Indian spices and chunks of cheese."
She took a spoonful and chewed on the rubbery vegan cheese. She wished she could find a place that used actual milk-based cheese like her mom used to. She pointed her spoon at Karen's plate.
"And what's that?"
Karen sawed again at her steak-like object.
"It's an old southern classic. Chicken fried steak with sausage gravy. A total salt and fat bomb, but it's great for that headache I'm trying to get rid of."
She swirled her fork in the lumpy grayish-white gravy.
"Can you imagine they actually used to kill cows and use real cream for this stuff? It's a miracle our ancestors didn't die of embarrassment, much less heart attacks. Just the thought of what they used to eat."
She shuddered. Priya smiled. She remembered just how good the real stuff was, and her goal was to eventually find a way to get some. But she wasn't about to tell Karen about her private little heresy. She didn't need a lecture from someone who was barely able to keep up with the school's course material. Wake up. The words were spelled out with taps on her scalp in Morse code. Startled, Priya popped her head up and looked around. Nobody in the lecture hall was paying attention to her. They were all busy scribbling notes as Professor Darby droned on like the giant bag of hot air he was. She whispered under her breath,
"What the hell, Harold?"
A barrage of taps rained on her head, and she imagined her hidden companion wagging his non-existent finger at her. You shouldn't sleep in a classroom. What if something happens that you need to be aware of?
Give me a break. This QFT class is mind-numbingly remedial. Darby hasn't had an original idea since maybe ever.
At the front of the hall, the professor droned on. An operator acting on identical bosons can be described in terms of n-particle wave functions, the first quantized formalism, or in terms of creation and annihilation operators in the Fock space, the second quantized formalism. This exercise is about converting the operators from one formalism to another.
I can do this stuff in my sleep, Priya whispered, so why don't you let me get back to it?
Harold remained silent. Either he had no good retort or he was just being moody. Harold was an AI, encased in a form that was much more advanced than anything Priya had ever encountered. It could shapeshift to physically mimic almost anything, including, as he was doing now, her hair and skin. He was also a family heirloom of sorts. Buried within him were memories of every Radcliffe from the Great Exodus until now. But he'd been particularly grumpy of late. Sometimes Priya wondered if he'd been mimicking her in the personality department as well. Despite that, or perhaps because of it, she got along better with Harold than with just about anyone else. The lecture came to a close, and the students began filing out of the auditorium. Priya hesitated to join them, thinking of the odd meeting scheduled for her in the hallway outside. It wasn't in her nature to shy away from confrontation. But then again, she didn't often have to confront unknown colonels with equally unknown agendas.
Miss Radcliffe?
Priya nearly jumped out of her skin. A tall man in a military uniform was standing right next to her. This must be Colonel Jenkins.
I told you you shouldn't sleep in a classroom, Harold tapped, still hiding in her rat's nest of hair.
The man extended his hand and gave her a crooked smile.
I snuck in while you were napping. Pretty ballsy to do in a level 700 class, but it fits your profile.
Priya shook his hand and silently fumed at Harold for not having warned her he was there.
I presume you received my email last night?
I did, but...
I'll explain on the way.
The colonel motioned for her to follow as he took a step toward the exit. Priya had to jog to catch up. The man's strides were easily half again as long as hers. Outside the Arts and Sciences building, Jenkins turned toward the north part of the campus.
Where are we going?
Priya asked. The colonel gestured toward a tall building ahead of them.
The Space and Science Museum.
The museum? Why?
But Priya had a more pressing question.
Exactly what branch of the military are you with? Your signature in the email listed UNSOC, but I couldn't find a sensible definition for that online.
The colonel gave her a sidelong glance.
It stands for the United Nations Special Operations Command. We don't advertise, but let's just say we report directly to the UN's First Council.
Priya was not that into politics, but she knew the First Council was the top of the governmental food chain, which meant that whatever UNSOC was, it was a serious thing, with access to some serious people who controlled some serious funding. And if she learned anything in her recent years of rubbing elbows with folks in academic circles, it was that funding was key to making any advances in the sciences. At the entrance to the museum, the colonel flashed his badge at the guard on duty. The man nodded, walked them past a line of tourists, and buzzed them through a reserved set of turnstiles. Priya started to ask another question, but Colonel Jenkins held up a hand.
Let's go to a secure area before continuing our conversation.
Priya pressed her lips together as she followed the man through the museum. To her surprise, her feeling of dread had vanished, replaced by a tingle of excitement. She hoped this was some weird recruiting strategy. She already intended to join the service after graduation, but if he asked her to join now, she might just say yes. As they walked past old mock-ups of early space shuttles from the 20th and 21st centuries, a synthesized voice came through speakers in the ceiling. On December 20th, 2019, now known as 47.354 PE, Donald Trump, President of the United States, signed into law the formation of the United States Space Force. It would remain known as the USSF for decades, until 45 years after the Great Exodus, on 45.30 AE, when the Space Force was moved under the purview of the United Nations. Stardate 45 corresponded with the early 22nd century, a time when the separate nations were in the process of merging under one umbrella government led by the United Nations. It was also a period of global unrest. Priya's history classes had glossed over that period of Earth's history, but there was enough data on the web to glean the truth. There were riots, uprisings, general chaos. People resisted the change to a global government. That was understandable. Change was hard. Some sources said that only the UN's imposition of martial law was ultimately able to quiet things down. Priya followed the colonel past a scaled-down but still huge replica of a spaceship. On Stardate 151.23, UN Secretary General Natalia Poroshenko signed the final approval for building Voyager, humanity's first interstellar space cruiser. Details of its construction remain classified, but the design is said to be based on a nearly 200-year-old schematic drafted by Dr. David Holmes himself. Jenkins ushered Priya through a door that read, "For military personnel only." They walked down a hall and stopped in front of an unmarked metal door with no handle. A uniformed military policeman stood next to it, glowering. The colonel handed his ID to the MP, who ran it through a scanning device, handed it back, and snapped a salute. Jenkins hitched his thumb toward Priya.
"I've pre-authorized Priya Radcliffe for a one-day pass. I'll be her escort."
"Yes, sir."
The sergeant, whose hand was never more than a few inches from the sidearm strapped to his waist, turned to her.
"Miss Radcliffe, I presume you have a CAC on you."
Every student on campus had been assigned a common access card. It was what allowed her entry into the various academic buildings. She dug hers out of her pocket and presented it to the sergeant. He ran it through his scanner. When a green LED lit up on the device, he handed the card back to her and pressed a button on a black box attached to his belt. Something buzzed, and the colonel pushed the door open and gestured for her to follow. She stepped through into a short, plain, unpainted concrete hallway. The door swung shut behind them, and Priya felt the air pressure change as it sealed itself closed. Her ears popped. Then a door at the far end of the corridor opened. The colonel started forward, Priya hurrying to match his long strides.
"Getting permission to bring you here took more signatures than you could ever imagine," he said. "But remember, everything you see and hear from here on in is classified."
They passed through the open door into a huge room that looked like a hangar. At its center, a large metal frame was being constructed by dozens of remotely operated devices. Some were welding gangplanks between sections of the frame. Others were spooling wires from one end of the structure to another. Camera drones flitted through the air, taking images from every angle.
"Do you know what you're looking at?" Jenkins said.
Priya couldn't suppress the smile on her face. Over the years, she'd seen plenty of space shuttles and other space-bound ships. She'd seen takeoffs and landings, sometimes from quite close. But this was something very different. The structure in front of her was only a small piece of a much, much larger ship, a ship she'd just seen a replica of back in the museum.
"I thought they were building this up in space," she said, her heart racing. "I mean, it can't really be. Is this really a piece of Starship Voyager?"
"It is." Jenkins smiled and pointed from one end of the room to the other. "Priya Radcliffe, welcome to SAMR, the Starship Advanced Metallurgic Engineering and Research Facility. This is the heart of Project Voyager."
With a curl of his finger, he motioned for her to follow.
"Let's introduce you to some members of the team."
Chapter 2 Priya sat alone in Colonel Jenkins' office. As she waited for the colonel to return, she fiddled with three small cubes of metal sitting on his desk. They looked identical, but they were different weights. A desktop digital scale confirmed it.
"Harold, what do you think of these?" she said. "I wonder if it's possible that—"
"Be cautious," Harold tapped on her head. "I detected a radio frequency transmitter activation nearby, just as you began talking. You're likely being monitored."
Priya's words caught in her throat. Why would anyone be listening? Yet she trusted Harold. He was a gift from her parents, and though they didn't have a chance to share much about him before they were killed, they had told her two things: to always keep him a secret, and to always heed his warnings. She pressed her lips together and tapped her teeth in a rhythm that the AI would detect.
"Did I say anything wrong?" "Anyone listening may naturally wonder who Harold is."
She winced and cleared her throat. then fiddled with the cubes again and let out what she hoped sounded like a self-deprecating laugh.
I swear, if anyone heard me talk...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?